From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is out this week. I'm Bob Garfield. For weeks now, the Obama campaign has been hitting Mitt Romney hard over claims that during his tenure as CEO of Bain Capital, he outsourced American jobs. As you might imagine, the Obama campaign has aggressively pushed this claim in ads in crucial swing states.
Mitt Romney's companies were pioneers in outsourcing U.S. jobs to low-wage countries. Running for governor, Mitt Romney campaigned as a job creator.
I know how jobs are created.
But as a corporate raider, he shipped jobs to China and Mexico. The Washington Post has just revealed that Romney's companies were pioneers in shipping U.S. jobs overseas.
And the president has hit the same point hard in speeches.
Let me tell you, Tampa, we do not need an outsourcing pioneer in the Oval Office. We need a president who will fight for American jobs.
The problem is that Romney denies the charge, and the Obama campaign cannot prove it's true. FactCheck.org, among others, has written that the outsourcing at Bain Capital took place in the years after Romney surrendered management of the company and its assets to run the Salt Lake City Olympics in February of 1999. It's a murky issue, made murkier by Thursday's Boston Globe report, revealing numerous government filings by Romney from 1999 to 2002, indicating he remained sole owner of the company and was getting compensation for management duties. Romney's camp has asked for a correction. The Globe has refused. According to political scientist and media critic Brendan Nyhan, the story would be a lot less confusing if the media would just do a better job.
The Obama campaign has released a series of ads that suggest to viewers that Romney was actively participating in shipping jobs overseas, in particular to China and Mexico. While the legal status of his employment at Bain is murky during the period in question, they haven't been able to provide any direct evidence that he had day-to-day control or operational responsibility for any of those decisions.
Your piece not only took off on the Obama campaign for making these unverifiable charges, but also the press for continuing to report the charges without bothering to take note of the fact-checking and without going out on its own to see if the Obama campaign's claims hold water.
We've seen a lot of he said, she said reporting. The Obama campaign says X, Romney says Y, who knows who's right? And, you know, the other thing we've seen is a lot of analysis of tactics. Is this a successful approach for the Obama campaign? Who's likely to win this debate? Who's going to gain the advantage from it? And that sort of punditry is often not especially useful.
Among the news organizations you say that have done exactly this kind of he said, she said reporting, you know, we're not talking about minor players. We're talking about the LA Times, the AP, CBS News. If I understand your charge, the big boys are kind of carrying the water for the Obama campaign by simply not doing enough truth squatting on the claims.
News organizations have to take some responsibility when they air these claims for trying to verify them, particularly if they're central to the campaign in the way that I think Romney's experience at Bain will be. They need to invest the time and resources in reporting the story out, or at the least for those publishing after the factcheck.org piece came out, they could at least refer their viewers or readers to that story to give them some sense of the evidence supporting these claims.
On Thursday, the Boston Globe broke a story that said, according to SEC filings, Romney was in full financial control of Bain as late as 2002, 3 years after he had previously said he left the company. The Globe story doesn't provide evidence that he was still wielding the levers of power there, but that at least on paper, he was in charge.
And to many people's mind, that may make him morally responsible for decisions made by Bain in that period. And that's a perfectly fair argument to have. But it's important to note here that factcheck.org has considered this evidence already, as have other media outlets and reporters. Just a quote from their response, "Nothing in the SEC documents contradicts what Romney has certified as true, which is the statement that he was not in active operational control of Bain during this period." So these SEC filings, to those of us who have been following the debate closely, don't change the answer to the question of who had operational control as far as we know.
So we actually know not much more than we did a day ago. But suddenly, Obama doesn't have to answer for his claims. Romney has to answer for his.
That's right. The news here is Romney's campaign's evolving denials as opposed to the Obama ads, which at this point in our 24-hour news cycle are old news. As people shift to parsing the various responses from the Romney campaign, it gets harder and harder for them politically.
What's so frustrating about this is that these issues are not unknowable. Every company that was owned or controlled by Bain had employees who either were on the phone and in contact with Mitt Romney or were not. There's lots of them. As far as I know, there is not a single reporter who has been able to locate these live human beings.
It's amazing that more of this hasn't come out. It certainly seems like a knowable, answerable question. This story isn't going away. Obama would love nothing more than to keep talking about the potentially negative side of Romney's wealth and business experience from now until November. So the press does need to sort this out, and it needs to figure out not just what the truth is, but how to present that truth in a way that's both accurate and succinct enough to fit into the kind of day-to-day campaign stories we typically see.
Is this story most indicting of one of the following? The Obama campaign's ethics, Mitt Romney's veracity, or the American political system that makes this a story along Jeremiah Wright lines?
I'll go with C. I think A and B are matters of personal opinion. But what we do see here are some of the institutional weaknesses of the American press. The objective ideal of journalism has many virtues, but unfortunately, it provides a disincentive for getting to the truth when there are conflicting claims, because that's an awkward thing to do. And so we see a lot of reluctance to dig deeper. But this is a case where we just don't have any other choice.
Thank you, Brendan.
Thank you.
Brendan Nyhan is a writer and assistant professor of government at Dartmouth College. The Pew Research Center recently reported that America is more divided along partisan lines than at any other time in the past 25 years. As a society, their research reveals, we're more divided by politics than we are by class, race, or gender. So thank goodness we have an internet to prey on our weaknesses, or maybe help diminish them. Developer Pascal Redig has created a website where you input your phone number and your political stripe, and you're paired up telephonically with someone on the other end of the ideological spectrum. The site is called PoliticalScreamingMatch.com. Here's a tape of a call between two people who disagree about President Obama's health care overhaul.
Socialist.
Hello?
Socialist. It's making us all socialists.
Why am I a socialist?
Redick says Political Screaming Match is actually designed to help save the world rather than destroy it. It's designed as an experiment to see what happens when people who disagree talk privately and intimately.
I just wanted to see what would happen. Just like you get a comment on the web, you know that chances are the person behind whatever horrible thing was written is not a deep down bad person. The question is, you know, what makes them turn into that sort of horrible person, and what can we do to prevent that from happening?
And what was your best guess as to how this would play out?
I thought it would sort of go in the middle. I thought, you know, I've actually been surprised that I haven't seen any crazy calls. Every time I press play on one of the recordings, I sort of wince and ask myself, what have I done, and, you know, what is about to hit me? I'm sure there'll be one of those, but so far, so good. Apparently, you know, the internet trolls, they don't want to give up their cell phone numbers.
We started with a snippet of conversation between two ideological opposites. It began a little confrontational, but here's the same conversation a little bit later.
Why am I a socialist?
I thought that's how we played this game.
Oh, wait. You're a fascist.
Well, you're a socialist.
I am, though. I, like, literally am a socialist. Well, Marxist.
That's cool. Some of my friends are. Sometimes I think I am.
Now, they seem to have calmed down a bit.
The conversation sort of goes, even though it was originally about Obamacare, sort of goes all over the board. You know, by the end, they're sort of talking about some finer points of a whole bunch of different issues.
Now, you say that you've heard some fairly thoughtful conversations from people who you would have expected to be caustic and bitter and dismissive. Mm-hmm. Have you seen the scales falling from anyone's eyes? Have you seen enlightenment, a whole change of worldview based on one of these conversations?
So I haven't, unfortunately, seen anyone's worldview change, but I think I have seen people at least understand where the other person was coming from. You know, that there hasn't been necessarily been an agreement, but, you know, someone might say, I understand coming from where you grew up or where you did this, or why you feel that way. That's a good first step. I don't think anyone's whole position on anything has been changed, but at least maybe there's a little bit more understanding.
So there's, I think, two ways to consume political media. One is to filter every single thing that you read, see, and hear through your own worldview, your own ideology, your own immutable doctrine. And the other, which is the one that OTM kind of subscribes to, is to pay attention and learn stuff and see what effect that might have on your thinking. When you name a website politicalscreamingmatch.com, don't you more or less foreclose on the possibility that people who subscribe to the second media consumption philosophy are never going to log on?
You know, I think there's that possibility, although I think the people who subscribe to the second idea are more interested in the meta game, you know, interested in the discussion about the discussion, you know, and that might attract them to it. But I think, you know, the people who look at it through, you know, red or blue colored glasses, you know, also are probably the most interesting to listen to. Go at it.
You mean from a voyeuristic point of view, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just you get a sick and perverse pleasure in just watching the insanity unfold.
Yeah, but I mean, I think there's also a bigger possibility for one of the sides to learn something. Coming into Political Screaming Match and having, you know, sort of this, you know, anonymous call with someone might, you know, open you up to something that otherwise you might not be willing to, because you never really talk to someone from the other side. You only hear the sound bites.
Pascal, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Pascal Redig is the programmer and founder of PoliticalScreamingMatch.com.
Coming up, the curse of Rolodex journalism. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, offering a new professional service to help manage business reputations, ratings, and reviews on the Internet. More at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield with a few of your letters. Last week, we spoke to BuzzFeed founder Jonah Peretti about allegations that his website, which is a sort of compendium of viral goodness, often borrows material from elsewhere without sufficient credit. Users of the website Reddit, one of the sites mentioned, objected what they saw as our characterization of the site. Wrote Robert Sevens from Florida, quote, "You really did a disservice to the online site Reddit when it was described in this piece as, quote, a site where lots of people discuss funny things online. It is a social news site, and though the young male contingent of its users can't get over themselves about how funny they are, international and U.S. news, politics, technology, and science discussions attract large numbers of users." Another comment from a person with the username Sleet01 made a similar point. Quote, "Your reporting did little justice to the Reddit site or its communities. I understand the story was meant to cover BuzzFeed, but Reddit is so much more than, well, BuzzFeed." Point taken. Our rebroadcast of a piece about the world of late-night TV pitchmen prompted listeners to write in with reminiscences about their own experiences. Elizabeth Bird from Landers, California, told us how she bought a picture hanger from Billy Mays. Bird writes, "Billy said the purchasers would get them for life, to which I paid zero attention. Hangers were mailed to me about every 3 to 4 months for free. Just one little glitch, however, the shipping and handling cost $5.95 per shipment. Late night TV, caveat emptor." We also got heaps of mail about a story we didn't broadcast. Here's one such letter from Jacob Metcalf, quote, "Dear OTM, I would love to have your take on this story. Joe Olivo is a small business owner who appears all over the media, supposedly neutrally representing the views of small business owners and their dislike of workers' rights and health care reform. In fact, NPR has interviewed him twice, including last Sunday in a story about minimum wage requirements. The writer goes on to explain that Joe Olivo is actually a member of the National Federation of Independent Business, the lead plaintiff in the Obamacare case decided by the Supreme Court. According to Metcalf and several other astute listeners who contacted us, NPR and other outlets have failed to identify him as anything but the humble owner of a print shop about to be crushed by big government. Metcalf ends with this quote, "This strikes me as just the kind of story you would cover, illustrating a disturbing trend in journalism." All right, Jacob, all right. We'll cover it. On a lazy summer's day a week ago, NPR host Guy Raz of Weekend All Things Considered was 7 minutes into a story on the minimum wage.
From Iowa. Now, opponents of his bill do point to jobs, that with such high unemployment, an increase in the minimum wage will actually make it worse. That's what Joe Olivo argues. He owns a small printing press in New Jersey, and he employs 47 people. And I asked Olivo how a higher minimum wage would affect him.
It has the effect of lifting the entire wage scale up, because what happens is the employee that's been here for maybe 3 years and has more experience than the person making an entry-level wage, they will rightfully want
the interviewee was Joe Olivo, proprietor of Perfect Printing in Moorestown, New Jersey, and it would seem quite a find, a real-life small businessman who can articulate a policy question succinctly and without rancor. In fact, he was equally good a week earlier in a morning edition piece on healthcare by NPR's Yoki Noguchi.
The legislation will give some small businesses tax incentives to pay for employee healthcare. Starting in 2014, those with 50 or more employees will be required to provide it. That's bad news for businesses like Perfect Printing in Moorestown, New Jersey. Joe Olivo is its president. Olivo says he now has 48 employees for whom he pays some health care coverage, but he's intensely aware of crossing that 50-person threshold and will think very hard before hiring more people so he can avoid hitting government requirements that he says will raise his health care costs.
It's really going to slow down how much I wish to grow, because I'm going to have to put a lot of money.
Olivo is a find, all right. If you've been paying attention, you could find him on NBC.
For small business owners like Joe Olivo, it is the unknown cost of the law that could impact his printing business.
Without a doubt, it's something that we're ready to expand. And at this point, what I'll do is either hold off, or I may hire part-time employees. And
CNBC, MSNBC, Fox News Channel, Fox News Channel, Fox Business News, Fox Business News, and Fox News Channel. Minimum wage, taxation, and especially health care reform. For years, Olivo has become one of the media's go-to voices of Main Street. Call him Joe the Printer. Journalistically, this speaks to a certain poverty of imagination. It also speaks to a poverty of information, because hardly anyone bothers to mention Olivo's membership and New Jersey leadership position in the National Federation of Independent Business, an advocacy group that has been advocating hard against health care reform since the Clinton administration. And how do reporters and producers find Joe the Printer? Some, of course, see his name elsewhere in the press, but often enough they are given his name by the National Federation of Independent Business. Joe Olivo.
Because of their size and the media contacts they have, they've certainly given the ability to me, when I feel that I need to get my message out, it is something that they help me do at times. Other times, it's reporters calling me directly.
Olivo hastens to add that he isn't on the organization's payroll, doesn't even accept reimbursement of his expenses, and never says a single word in public that doesn't reflect his honest-to-God day-to-day challenges trying to run a family business.
I'm telling a story, and yes, I may be telling it over and in different variations on different networks, but it's my story, so I don't really understand what there is to discover or what else they would need to disclose.
Well, if you heed the left-wing blogosphere, NPR, NBC, Fox, and the rest should have disclosed that Olivo is a Trojan horse for moneyed conservative interests who will spare no subterfuge to destroy Obamacare. But perhaps a more reasonable line of argument is, don't news organizations owe their audience enough information to evaluate the motives and affiliations of the speaker? That's precisely the question we posed to NPR Ombudsman Edward Schumacher Matos, who sort of shrugged.
Does it look embarrassing? Yeah, it looks embarrassing. But is there a major ethical issue here? No. Clearly, he represents a point of view. And so the bigger issue is, were the stories fair? Were the stories accurate? They were. both stories actually represented the other side of the view even more than they had Olivo's view. So that, to me, counts more than anything else. It's a judgment call, then, about how much you should say about this guy's background. I don't think they should have used him, but not because he had some relationship with the NFIB, but just because he was, you know, old and enough of this guy already.
As the listener's representative, as the proxy for the audience, when you hear a guy who was introduced giving whatever opinion on whatever subject, and there is no affiliation or context given, aren't you assuming that he is representing only himself?
He does represent only himself. He does not represent the organization. The issue is he representative or not? And I think he is representative of a large number, if not a majority, of small business people. That's the number one issue. Is he representative or not? And he is. Is he someone that they like to trot out a lot? Yes. Is he an official of the organization or a spokesperson for the organization? No.
Actually, he is in the NFIB state leadership, but never mind. Spokesman or not, Olivo is clearly a poster child, an active advocate against health care reform since 1993 when he traveled to Washington to protest the Clinton plan. Yet NPR, among other news organizations, led us to assume he was just some random guy discovered off the street. A source at NBC News told us their error of omission was an oversight. Schumacher Matos says his ombudsman column will take up the issue of journalistic laziness. How NPR News itself regards the episode, we cannot say. They refused to discuss it with us. On the question of repeatedly relying on the same sources, the Joe the Printer story jogged our memories here this week at OTM. Almost exactly 10 years ago, we took a broader look at that very subject in a piece we called Rolodex Journalism. Some of the details are a little dated. Peter Goodman is no longer at the Washington Post. He's now executive business editor of the Huffington Post. And nowadays, when we refer to a Rolodex, it's more likely to be a metaphor than an actual physical thing that sits on your desk. But the facts still stand in this golden oldie.
Major Strasser has been shot. Round up the usual suspects.
Here's the difference between Captain Renault, prefect of Casablanca Police, and the media. Renault had a whistle. Otherwise, the methodology is pretty much the same. A story breaks, expert analysis is required, turn to the Rolodex and round up the usual suspects. If it's a legal issue, find Alan Dershowitz. If it's an FBI investigation, call ex-G-man James Kallstrom. Conservative politics, William Kristol. Advertising? Well, modesty forbids.
Are there any advertisers that would say that O.J. Simpson could be good for them?
Not any advertiser of substance. You know, this endorsement business is not just about name recognition and notoriety. It's about respect and credibility and likability. And O.J.'s never going to regain that. 70% of the American people still thinks the guy got away with murder. It's just not going to happen. You know, they could acquit the Menendez brothers, too, but they're not going to be the Double Mint twins.
Did whoever called me to book that interview call me because I was involved in the O.J. story? No. Because I'd written something especially trenchant on the subject? No. Because I was just the right person to provide context and detail? No. It was because the story concerned advertising pitchmen, and in her Rolodex under A for advertising, she found my name. And it happens every day in broadcast and print thousands and thousands of times, with varying degrees of suitability and a whole lot of deja vu. Robert Thompson is a professor of journalism and mass media at Syracuse University.
Because journalism goes off at the alarmingly quick rate that it does, people do collect Rolodexes. They're people they know they can get a hold of on a moment's notice. And I think there is this kind of aristocracy of commentators that gets created as a result of it.
I myself have landed in that Burke's peerage of punditry, but there's another one of my peers who is really without peer. He is Norman Ornstein, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, and probably the most quoted non-government official in Washington. He may be listed in a lot of Rolodexes under P for politics and, say, C for Congress. He should be under O, not for Ornstein, but for O negative. He's the universal donor, spilling his life's blood 2,000 to 3,000 times a year. In the past 2 weeks, he's been flooded with calls about Homeland Security, but...
I've had calls on the budget. I've done phone calls on Ben Gilman. I've done things on the farm bill.
You get the point. And Ornstein gets the calls because he's a dependable source on damn near anything, which is handy, but in terms of broadening debate on a given subject, not necessarily ideal. Furthermore, there's the question of actual reporting versus just filling in the blanks. Not to point any fingers, but let's just say it isn't too hard to write a story before conducting an interview, leaving spaces with notations like Ornstein quote here. The king of quotes himself acknowledges that.
I find now, compared to 10, 15, 20 years ago, a lot more laziness on the part of reporters, people who turn to the same sources because they pretty much know what they're going to get and there isn't any use in looking around.
The result, says Professor Thompson, is the usual suspects phenomenon, which for all its advantages to reporters and producers can be antithetical to genuine inquiry.
I think the Rolodex in the end becomes part of the, is one of the most important tools in the toolbox of a good journalist. I think what we may be looking for is a need for that Rolodex to have a more diverse set of voices within it.
For instance, a search of the New York Times database for the past 2 years yields 42 stories, quoting consumer advocate Gene Kimmelman, head of the Washington Office of the Consumers Union. Now, Washington is just lousy with consumer advocates, but Kimmelman rules. Of course, the Times has nothing on the Washington Post, which in the same period quoted Kimmelman 58 times, including, on January 23, 2001, an astonishing 3 times in 3 separate stories, all on section fronts. That's right, the coveted trifecta. Kimmelman chuckled over his breakfast. Meanwhile, in the Washington Post newsroom, reporter Peter Goodman ambivalently accepted the congratulations of his colleagues because while Kimmelman was the horse that won 3 races in one day, Goodman was the jockey in the mount. Yes, one reporter wrote all 3 stories, quoting the same man.
It's both an anomaly and a symptom of a larger problem. There's no question that the beat reporter in Washington is harried and frantic and is too prone to doing the easiest thing, which in this case was reaching someone who's, you know, delightfully easy to get a hold of and who gives good quote. So for that, I'm guilty. We, the members of the media, are guilty. And, let's be real. You know, I should have worked harder to get some other voices in the paper.
You can't much fault Goodman, to switch back to Professor Thompson's metaphor, if he is guilty of nothing more than using the right tool for the job on 3 separate jobs that happen to coincide. If the job calls for a hammer, you grab a hammer. What reporters and producers need to do, Thompson says, is to keep a large and diverse toolbox so that they're not using a hammer to put in a screw. Strangely, the biggest toolboxes of all probably belong to cable news. For all its notorious sensationalism and superficiality, cable may provide more diversity of expert analysis than the largest newspapers, owing not to its nuanced coverage, we know it doesn't provide that, but simply to its insatiable appetite for ever more experts to fill all those chairs on camera 24 hours a day. Each network has a central database of 50,000 names. So precious is his Rolodex collection to Fox News Channel's chief booker Eric Spinato that each evening before he leaves work, he places his under lock and key.
It could be a janitor. I don't know who's looking through my Rolodex. They could, again, take someone's home number that if they trusted me with it, how am I? I'm being negligent by leaving it out for others to scour through.
Imagine this scenario. You're at the beach. Your wife is standing with her back to the ocean. Next to her are your 7 Rolodexes. You see a huge wave gathering, and it's just about to break. What do you do?
Grab the Rolodexes in one hand and grab the wife's hand on the other and leave. The Rolodex is our life.
That's because while the problems of 2 people don't amount to a hill of beans in this crazy world, the fate of 50,000 experts and pundits could affect the Hannity and Combs show and Special Report with Brit Hume and the O'Reilly Factor. Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but someday and for the rest of your life. Coming up, while you're reading your Kindle is reading you. Also, the pros and cons of binging on your favorite TV show. This is On the Media.
You must remember this. A kiss is still a kiss. A sigh is just a sigh.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, offering a new professional service to help manage business reputations, ratings, and reviews on the Internet. More at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration to address the world's pressing environmental problems. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for improving education and enrichment for children, both in and out of school, at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Last month, the Association of American Publishers announced a milestone. 2012 is the first year that adult ebooks have outsold adult hardcover books. For the publishing industry, those ebook sales are especially valuable because they bring in not just revenue, but data. As you read from your Kindle, your Nook, or your iPad, the device transmits all the details of how you do your reading. Data that is beginning to shape the way books are written. Wall Street Journal reporter Alexandra Alter says that the new data is a big deal for an industry that has traditionally been unable to measure its audience.
For them to be able to see most readers are skipping the introduction of this book, most readers are heavily underlining the third chapter of this book, that's a pretty good indication of what is of interest to large groups of readers. They can use that to tailor books to people's tastes more. Of course, not every book will be put through a focus group. I mean, you're not going to have Jonathan Franzen's next novel cut in half because 30% of people didn't finish Freedom, 25% of people didn't finish The Corrections. But I have talked to publishers who said, you know, they would like to have this kind of information. They wish Amazon would share it. Barnes & Noble intends to share some of it with publishers. So they're looking forward to having a better sense of what readers like.
So that they can sell more of the same to the readers who clearly favor a certain genre, but also so that they can help authors fine-tune manuscripts to make them more attractive to readers?
Yes, a couple of publishers have already started releasing early digital editions of books, getting reader feedback on what they like and don't like, and then kind of tailoring the print edition to reflect those tastes and comments and all that feedback. So some of that is happening already, mostly with some of your new, more digitally savvy publishers.
And would the data be able to tell what editors have long since been dependent on to decide whether it takes too long to get to the plot, whether it bogs down around page 150. Will data begin to usurp the functions of live human beings?
I think you will always need editors, but I think it will clarify some of those assumptions. I mean, publishing has always been kind of an instinct-driven business. If, you know, of course, it's stocked with English majors, not number crunchers. And a lot of the decisions about what books to acquire, how to edit them, what length they should be, those are made by people who love books. So you'll certainly, I think, have those people weighing in and making those choices, but they might take into account if, you know, most readers quit the book halfway through, or you can even tell if somebody puts the book, you know, down a few times. So if the reader gets to the end and they suddenly decide they're going to stop reading that and read another book for 2 weeks and then come back and maybe they'll see how it ends, you could probably deduce that that wasn't dramatic enough.
Hmm. So there's two nightmare scenarios. One is the privacy one, which we'll get to in a moment. But the other is taking the human element out of fiction. Now, I understand Jonathan Franzen is at no risk, but I can certainly see publishers, if once they get a hold of this information, bringing this data to bear on genre authors. And what gets lost in the process, potentially, seems to me, is the author's voice. If everything gets informed by data, do we lose something fundamental about literature?
That could be a risk. On the other hand, if you look at the bestseller list and what's popular, it's pretty diverse. Hilary Mantel's Tudor drama, Bring Up the Bodies, the sequel to Wolf Hall, is on the bestseller list. So are a bunch of crime fiction novels. So is The Hunger Games. Publishers have always catered to a variety of tastes.
You know, actually, I thought you were going to give me a different answer. I thought you were going to say, if you look at the bestseller lists, it's already pre-crappy for your convenience. James Patterson is formulaic enough. He's not going to need any help from an algorithm.
Well, that could be true as well, but you do see a range occasionally popping up.
Let's get finally to the privacy issue. What if a law enforcement agency went to Amazon and said, we'd like to see what Alexandra Alter has been reading the last 6 months, where she started, where she stopped, what she highlighted, because, you know, we're just suspicious about this woman.
That's definitely a concern. In fact, a couple of organizations, the American Civil Liberties Union and the Electronic Frontier Foundation, have raised this issue, and they managed to pass a law in California earlier this year called the Reader Privacy Act, which requires that law enforcement agencies get a court order before they can demand this kind of information, but it's certainly a risk. That kind of information could definitely be pulled if you were under suspicion for something. It could require that those companies turn over your individual reading habits.
I guess the question is, does the availability of this technology and the subpoenability of it put us all in danger of being in suspicion over something just on the basis of what we're reading, you know, in the privacy of our own Kindles?
I don't believe it would. I think this kind of information would be pulled by law enforcement if you were already under suspicion for something, if you were a suspect. I don't think there's combing through it to see what people are reading. That would take forever, and they would have no basis for going to the companies to get that information. So I don't think it's the kind of thing where, like, the cell phone calls are being tracked extensively. Certainly internet searches are probably looked at, but I don't think that law enforcement is going through people's digital reading habits. I think it would be basically a waste of their time at this point.
Alexandra, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Alexandra Alter covers books and culture for The Wall Street Journal. The availability of cheap knockoffs isn't just a problem for the makers of watches and handbags. Increasingly, knockoff books are being made. If you go onto Amazon's website, for example, to purchase Stieg Larsson's best-selling The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, you might stumble upon I Am the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, a completely unrelated book, self-published on Amazon through its Create Space imprint. A few months ago, we spoke to Fortune's senior editor, Stephen Gandell. He had looked into the knockoffs on Amazon and found a number of books that he says were clearly meant to confuse people by trading off of more popular titles.
There was Steve Jobs by Isaac Worthington, which sounds a lot like the book that's very popular now, Steve Jobs by Walter Isaacson. There was also 35 Shades of Grey by J.D. Light, which sounds a lot like 50 Shades of Grey, also by a two-initial author, E.L. James. There's a very well-selling book by a Nobel Prize-winning economist called Thinking Fast and Slow. Amazon, until recently, was selling a book called Fast and Slow Thinking. There's What to Expect When You're Expecting. And if you buy this book, you probably won't get the book you're expecting because it's not the very popular book.
But that's an actual title.
It's a book by someone else by the exact same title.
So if you get suckered into buying 35 Shades of Grey by J.D. Light, who in all probability doesn't exist, what do you get?
You get a book That's more like a pamphlet. It's not nearly as long as the real book. And most of these books that are knockoff books are printed in a very weird format. They're usually very large type, like Steve Jobs by Isaac Worthington, not the right book. It had about 40 words per page. There were huge words on each page, about 2 words per line. And it looked like the material was rewritten from the Wikipedia page. It followed the kind of outline of what's on the Wikipedia page. The reviewer for that book said, do not buy this book. This is a pamphlet. It looks like something that would be handed to you on a street corner.
You spoke to the author of I Am the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, not the late Stieg Larsson, but a woman named Karen Peebles, who claims to have written 10,000 books and published them through Amazon's Create Space.
She said she was a stay-at-home mom who homeschools her children, and this was a good way for her to get nice royalty checks with not having to leave the house. But I said to her, you know, there's this other very popular book that is called The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, and she said that when she wrote her book, she hadn't heard of it, but she wrote her book in 2008, well after the book was already internationally famous, and she chose not to publish it through Amazon until mid-2010, well-timed for the popularity of the book in the U.S., It seems less than coincidental.
Let's talk about the system that allows this scam to take place. The titles were published through this Amazon CreateSpace software. How is it that Amazon cannot filter out obvious, non-serious publishing content?
The comeback Amazon would have and say, well, we're not really the publisher. We're just distributing these self-publishing books. They don't have a real publishing relationship in the way the book industry thinks about them. Amazon doesn't acquire the rights to the books. They don't edit them. But to the average consumer, there's no way to know. When you go on the website, CreateSpace, Amazon's division is listed as the publisher. It should say the person's name there for the publisher if it's really a self-published book. But it doesn't. It has this CreateSpace label that makes you think, oh, I'm getting a real book, when what you're getting is not.
Has anyone committed a crime?
Titles of books are not copyrighted. So there's a gray line here. And there is a book titled The Dragon with the Girl Tattoo. You're able to sell that. I mean, clearly that's a parody and a new kind of work. When you're just trying to trick the consumer into buying your book because they think it's that other book, then that's illegal.
You know what, Steve? You should write a book about this very thing, and I know exactly what you should call it.
Lay it on me.
Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone.
I'm on it.
Stephen, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on.
Stephen Gandel is a senior editor for Fortune magazine. This Sunday, AMC's critically acclaimed drama Breaking Bad returns for the start of its fifth and final season.
You clearly don't know who you're talking to, so let me clue you in. I am not in danger, Skyler. I am the danger. A guy opens his door and gets shot, and you think that of me? No. I am the one who knocks.
I was a late adopter of this show, but I made up for lost time by plowing through seasons 1 through 3 in a 33-episode bender lasting 3 days. Leaving all other life duties aside, I lost myself in the rush, not unlike the meth tweakers who inhabit the series. It was glorious. I'm not alone in this sort of television binging, but on Slate this week, Jim Pagels told the binging world, in no uncertain terms, to cut it out. It was an unwelcome intervention. Bloggers and columnists took after Pagels, including an NPR.org piece that bemoaned the sort of commentator who sounds, quote, increasingly crank-like when they give consumption of culture instructions. Pagels is 20 and is something of a traitor to a generation of millennials that grew up with TV on demand. Jim, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Bob.
You know, I apologize to you. You are 20 years old. You're a college student. You interned for Slate. It is absolutely unfair for NPR.org and Time Magazine and now On the Media to try to take you down, but take you down I will. I'm a senior American. When I first started watching Captain Kangaroo, he was an ensign. I've watched TV the old way. I have binged on Breaking Bad, and it's been one of the greatest cultural experiences of my life. Tell me what I did wrong.
In going through all of these episodes very quickly, you kind of ruined the time in between the episodes when you can allow yourself to really put yourself in the character's shoes and really think about that time when you can say, if I were Walter White, what would I do given these circumstances?
A little exposition here. Walter White is the lead character of this show that is now entering its fifth season. And he is a high school chemistry teacher who winds up as one of the biggest manufacturers of methamphetamine in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hilarity and unhilarity ensues. And you find yourself able to relate to him between episodes.
Definitely. When I finish an episode, I just think, I cannot believe that Walt is in this position. I agonize over the decisions that he is forced to confront. And I feel if you immediately click play on the next episode, a lot of the pleasure that I get of putting myself in character's shoes somewhat evaporates to some degree.
You began, at least, by thinking that there is some sort of generational difference in how people consume media, especially TV.
Definitely, because most of my friends who watch television, these binge sessions, are, you know, college students who are used to staying up until 5 in the morning. Most of the adults I know, well, I didn't realize they're aware of these means of watching television.
Oh, thanks a lot. Yeah.
Well, most of them watch it either on network or they'll get the DVDs.
So when you discover that people of my generation, people who are just about clinically dead, have also binged, has this rocked your world?
Well, it's rather interesting because you're so open to shifting from have you watched television for 40, for 50 years to this binge-watching method, but you're so close to shifting back from the binge-watching to spacing out time. Whereas people of my generation, for the most part, when we came of age watching television, we've always pretty much for the most part had the opportunity to binge watch. When I first really got into television, Hulu and watching online were first kind of starting to get formed. We never really lived in this world where if we missed an episode of Friends, we might never see it again.
You've probably read some Dickens. You're an educated young guy.
Yes.
What are your favorites?
Great Expectations.
Great Expectations. Serialized.
Yes.
How did you read it?
I read it all in the course of one novel. Now, I know it was written in different chapters in a newspaper.
So, in other words, what you did was you read in essentially one fell swoop what the contemporaneous readers had to consume one chapter at a time. So what do you think of your proper way of watching Breaking Bad now? Huh?
Great Expectations, if you were to put that in film form, that would be a 4-hour film. Breaking Bad, if you were to put that in book form, that would be 12 to 13 times the length of Great Expectations. So I think if Great Expectations were the length of Breaking Bad in terms of the story length, I would certainly advocate breaking it up and enjoying it piece by piece.
Look, I want to hear from your mouth that my way of watching Breaking Bad is as valid as yours. Come on. You don't have to agree with my way. You got to just say, you know, some people like their corned beef with Russian dressing and some people like it with mustard. One is not better than the other. Come on.
Well, let me say, so when I was watching a film like, I don't know, Forrest Gump, a character in that movie, when they pass away at the end, I wasn't particularly emotionally distraught because I'd only known that character for 2 hours. But when I watch a show like The Wire and a character passes away at the end of season 5, I've spent years of my life with this character. So it really feels like a close friend of mine who I've known for a great deal of time has suddenly left my life.
Okay, it's an argument, but I got to tell you, I don't think it holds water because you can certainly build deep emotional bonds with someone in a very short period of time if you have shared an intense experience. And baby, 3 years worth of Breaking Bad in 72 hours, that's intense.
I'll certainly give you that.
Aha! Then will you give me this? You like your corned beef maybe with mustard. I like it with Russian dressing.
I just feel in one degree that corned beef is maybe a bit overcooked.
All right. Jim, I've enjoyed this.
Thank you. It was definitely a pleasure.
Jim Pagels is a senior at Columbia University, and he is a contributor to Slate.com. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sarah Abdurrahman, and Chris Neary, with more help from Amy DePiro and Eliza Novick-Smith. And it was edited this week by our senior producer, Katya Rogers. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Rob Grannis and Andrew Dunn. Ellen Horn is WNYC's Senior Director of National Programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find transcripts at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there. You can find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter, and you can email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.